Hi, this is Barry List at INFORMS, the Institute for Operations Research in the Management Sciences. You're listening to Science It Better, a series of podcasts about ways that analytics and math modeling is affecting people like you and organizations like your own. In today's segment, we speak with Justin Cohen of the Clinton Foundation and its Clinton HIV/AIDS Initiative. We're broadcasting from the Spring 2009 INFORMS Practice Meeting in Phoenix, Arizona. At the conference, operations researchers and experts in analytics have been discussing problems facing business and government, and in turn, the way that quantitative experts can find approaches to solving these problems. At the conference, Justin delivered a paper entitled Microbes, Medicine, and Math, Applying Operations Research to Global Health. Justin, welcome to the Science of Better.
Thank you, Barry.
Tell us about President Clinton's idea behind starting the Clinton HIV/AIDS Initiative. How is that abbreviated? Is it CHAI?
CHAI, we say CHAI.
You do? I see.
Means
like
life,
the T.
But also T in Africa.
Okay.
So it's a nice acronym. Yeah, the story that I've heard is that President Clinton originally wanted to focus on poverty, but one of the things that he learned when he talked to global leaders was that they said that you really couldn't address poverty without focusing on some of the fundamental underlying issues, and HIV/AIDS is one of the biggest of them. So CHAI was formed, I think, in 2002, and the mission is to bring high-quality care and treatment to people living with HIV and to improve healthcare systems in resource-poor countries. I think one of the interesting things about CHAI from an INFORMS perspective is that we have a real focus on applying business principles, the sorts of things that make any business run, trying to bring those ideas to global health.
Well, that's a very different perspective and sometimes a very helpful perspective.
Absolutely. And I think global health doesn't necessarily have that perspective. Back when I was doing my graduate work, they often said, you know, a CEO from a company would be sort of shocked if they saw how we ran things. So I think there's a lot of area in which we can improve and streamline and do all of the things that we're talking about here at this conference.
Here at the conference, you presented some upsetting UN statistics about disease and life expectancy in Africa. What's the life expectancy of Africans, and how does that compare to average life expectancy throughout the world?
Sure. I mean, there's a range. Remember that Africa is a very heterogeneous place.
So right.
There are places,
it is a continent.
It is an entire continent. But the global life expectancy is about 66 today, and that's in the United States, it's about 78, Japan 82. So I mean, that's the high end. And then when you look at sub-Saharan Africa, the average is only 47.
Wow.
So in some countries, Swaziland, for example, is one of the lowest. It's actually under 40. And this is a direct result of the fact that the prevalence of HIV and infectious diseases like HIV is so high. We're talking about losing some of the most productive years of life. These people aren't going to grow up to be able to see their kids, and they're not going to be able to meet their grandchildren.
And I would assume that there's a high child mortality death as well, and that's also bringing down the average age.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely, absolutely.
Which is sometimes the saddest of all.
Yes.
How has AIDS infection in Africa progressed since the disease was identified, I believe around 1990 or so?
Yeah, well, AIDS was actually identified as a new disease back in 81 in the United States.
Was it really?
And the earliest infection we can find was actually in a blood sample from 1959. So it's actually been around a really long time. But the pandemic that we know really grew heavily during the 80s and the 90s. So in Africa, we've seen the number of people grow quite dramatically through the 90s, up to about 33 million people who are now living with HIV. And about 60% of those people globally, 33 million, about 60% are living in Africa, despite the fact that only about 12% of the population of the world is in Africa. So there's definitely a very disproportionate burden of disease that's on Africa. Now, I would say in the last few years, we're seeing that level off. We are starting to see decreases in incidence, which is great. And we're starting to
see... Well, that sounds promising.
It is. And we're seeing some reductions in mortality as well. At least it's starting to level off. But it is leveling off at a very high level, about 2 million deaths per year, which is still very high.
2 million deaths a year throughout the world?
That's right, with disproportionately in Africa.
As I recall, you looked at the number of Africans receiving treatment and were alarmed by that. How does it play out in terms of numbers or percentages of those with the disease?
Yeah, sure. Well, we've actually seen really impressive growth in the number of people who are being treated. So we've grown, the numbers were about 265,000 back in 2002. We're now at about 3 million. So that's more than a tenfold increase over 5 or 6 years. And I think that's really impressive. At the same time, that's only about a third of what we actually need. So we still need to triple that amount if we're going to get treatment for all the people that need it.
Do you see it moving forward at the same rate as it has been, or has it slowed down?
I mean, it's going to be tough. It's still increasing right now, and that's the result of a tremendous effort by a lot of organizations, governments, donor organizations, NGOs, the Global Fund and PEPFAR, the President's Emergency Plan, have done really great things in getting people on treatment. But we still have a very long way to go, and it's going to require more resources, more financing, and using all of these resources in the most, in the best way possible.
As I recall, there was one statistic that's encouraging. It was about the number of HIV patients receiving antiretroviral medication. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think we alluded, but the treatment has increased very rapidly over the last few years. So you can look at countries like Namibia, where it was at 1% of the need in 2003. It made it all the way up to 88% in 2007. So that's a vast increase. Rwanda, pretty similar, 1% in 2003, up to about 70% in 2007. So we're seeing countries make really great strides. Unfortunately, that's not true everywhere. And there's still a way to go to get that last 30% or 20%. It's going to be very challenging for those countries.
You mentioned that the initial emphasis has been on scaling up care, and the next goal is efficiency. And efficiency is a layman's term that comes to mind when talking about analytics and OR. What are you referring to in terms of efficiency?
Yeah, I mean, I think when I think about global health, I really think that we're sort of leaving a second phase of global health. In the first phase of global health, we had to demonstrate that we really could treat and could prevent disease, even in the most remote corners of the earth. So these are the days when you might have read about in Mountains Beyond Mountains about Paul Farmer. He used to smuggle drugs in his suitcase.
Because, to Haiti, was it?
Right, exactly. Or we used to fly blood samples from one country to another country to run them. And we had to fly in doctors, expatriate doctors. So this is not an efficient way to do business, and it's not sustainable. So in the second phase of global health, what we're leaving right now, there's been a big emphasis on just getting drugs out there, getting preventive measures out there, trying to reach as many people as we can, no matter what the cost. And I think that's been the correct that's the correct goal, because people are dying and we have treatment, we have preventive activities. The thing is, moving forward, we still haven't reached everybody. And we are going to hit a wall at some point in terms of the amount of donor funding that's available and the amount of resources we have. So what we really need to do is to start using the resources we have available in a way that, I say, efficient. I mean, you could say better. We need to make sure we're getting the most out of every single dollar that we can, and that we're getting as many drugs as to where they need to go, and that we are doing it in the most cost-efficient way, and really stretching the buck.
You said that OR needs to become a standard ingredient in global health activities. Tell us what better analytics and OR can contribute to the fight for better health care.
Yeah, I mean, I think the opportunities are just limitless. I think global health is facing, when I say global health, it's shorthand for a vast array of different activities. I mean, we're talking everything from how a facility works to how global companies are making drugs and distributing them. So I think we're facing a lot of the same problems that OR has been tackling for years. And one of the things that I think is really important is that the global health community not reinvent solutions to these problems. I mean, we're talking about the need for supply chains. We know operations research has good answers to the supply chain questions. So we're looking at things like distributing commodities. How do we forecast drugs? And how do we forecast the right number of pediatric doses versus adult doses? How do we communicate those forecasts to small farmers who are growing the crops that go into those drugs? How do we maximize the use of limited human resources? Of course, this is a problem in every company. You have a set number of workers, and you need to get the most productivity out of them you can. In Africa, we have far too few doctors, and those doctors that do exist aren't necessarily being used in the most productive way. So, I mean, all of these issues, or lab results, we need to have a network of labs where we can send blood samples and get results back as quickly as we can. It's just a network problem like anything else operations research looks at. So there's a range from the local to the national to the global, and I think operations research is going to have a role to play on all of these levels.
You say that OR can help reduce costly mistakes. I believe you gave a couple examples in your talk of costly mistakes. Do you recall them?
Yeah, I mean, again, I think global health is new at this, and it's inevitable that they're going to do some things in a way that maybe is not as good as it could have been done. So whether or not these are mistakes or just places where we're learning, and we need some help from those who are actually doing analytics in order to do it better. But one of the places where I've been focusing a lot of energy is on drug forecasting. And I think we have places where we can really improve both on a national level and on a global level. So nationally, we see a lot of places where there's stockouts of important drugs. And that's just because, in many cases, the country didn't forecast properly and so didn't order enough to meet demand. Alternatively, there's a headline in a Ugandan newspaper from 2007 about how $2 million worth of ARVs and malaria drugs, HIV drugs and malaria drugs, were found expiring on a shelf in a warehouse. Oh. And at the same time, thousands of people didn't have access to drugs because they never made it from the warehouse to the districts where the facilities were. So, I mean, these are very simple problems, but they're very costly mistakes.
There may have also been human problems in terms of tracking.
Absolutely. They just aren't very good data systems in place. So the sort of simple supply chain solutions that we might think of are not necessarily applicable right now, but they certainly should be. And at a global level, I think it's the same issue. We don't have a very good feeling for how many drugs are really needed in each country. And so we need to think about the stability of our markets and how we can make sure that the small farmers are producing enough crop that we can get to the drug companies and make sure that we're meeting the global demand for these drugs.
You mentioned some of the obstacles that must be tackled before OR can contribute. And we might start with data, which is the lifeblood of all mathematical analysis. What's the problem with the data that's coming in right now?
Yeah, the problem with the data in global health is that often we don't have any,
which
is a massive problem. I've actually talked to some researchers here at Informs who have the same problem. So I don't think it's not a complete obstacle, but it is certainly a problem that we deal with on a day-to-day basis.
We know the expression garbage in, garbage out,
right.
But sometimes there's not even anything going
exactly.
in.
Exactly. I mean, one of the examples that I came across when I was putting together this talk is a place in Sierra Leone where there was a researcher from the University of Oslo that wanted to study infant deaths around pregnancy, mm-hmm. near when they were born. And the problem was that this is a region where there's no electricity. So certainly there can't be computer data systems like we might expect in the West. However, the health workers at the clinic were illiterate. So there couldn't be paper records. So how do you collect data when you have these workers that just have these incredible challenges? And so the solution he came up with was he made a box, and he cut holes in the box and then drew little pictures, so of a live baby and a dead baby and things like that. And then each time one of these events happened, the workers would place a pebble in the box. And then every quarter or so, the box gets taken to a district level, and the pebbles are counted, and then the numbers are entered into a data system. So, I mean, this is not an ideal solution.
It's actually a wonderful solution because you didn't think there could be a solution at all.
Right. So we managed to get data out of a place where, by all rights, you might think you couldn't get any data.
You couldn't put several years into teaching them language.
Right. And teaching them to read would also be, I think, a useful thing to do down the road. But in the short term, certainly, I think this is a good example of the sort of improvisation that can help us do the sorts of analytics we need to do despite the difficult conditions. But it's certainly a problem, and it's one that we encounter on a day-to-day basis. Work is done.
And we've kind of touched on it, but what's the disconnect between public health officials and operations research analysts?
I mean, frankly, I don't think the public health world, really knows that operations research even exists. I mean, I don't think I did when I was in grad school. It's not something that came up. It's not to say we don't deal with similar problems. I think we've talked about that. And it's not to say that we don't have a similar quantitative foundation. So I'm an epidemiologist, and I had a lot of background in things like mathematical transmission modeling. Infectious disease epidemiologists do similar sorts of modeling work. It's just more focused on the disease agents than on the actual logistics of how do you get a product from one place to another. So I think there's common ground, but right now the two worlds just aren't really talking to each other. And I think certainly there is a lot of space for operations research to collaborate with public health, but it'll require things like finding ways to pay for it. We're going to need some new novel kinds of donor mechanisms in order to get operations researchers into the games.
It seems like there are some bright spots on the horizon. You talked about the Gates Foundation, and you touched briefly on, is it PEPFAR? Is that the way it's...
Right, PEPFAR, the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief.
Tell us a little bit about PEPFAR and Gates and also the Global Health Delivery Project, GHD.
Yeah, sure. I mean, these are all pretty high-profile groups that are starting to recognize, I think, they have begun to recognize the importance of data-driven solutions. So we could take the Gates Foundation. They have a new delivery group. And the idea is that you can't just spend money on developing new vaccines, because we need to make sure we also have a way to get those vaccines to all the people that need them. And that's a great concern, that maybe we'll get a really effective preventative measure, but we don't have the system in place to actually get it out into the field. Global Health Delivery Project is a group that Paul Farmer and Jim Kim from Partners in Health founded at Harvard. And they do similar work trying to look at best practices and case studies around how to do this delivery work. And then PEPFAR. PEPFAR is actually the largest commitment by any nation to combat a single disease ever. They've given almost $20 billion for HIV thus far and are scheduled to give a lot more. It's really been a massive undertaking. They have bought drugs for over 2 million people and saved, they estimate, greater than 3 million adult years of life. So it's massive. And I think recently in their latest round of funding, they emphasized that all of their projects now must set aside some resources to do monitoring and evaluation and to do some impact evaluation. And so I think we're starting to see that sense from donors that they need to make sure they know where their money is going and that they need to know how much of an impact it's having.
And certainly the U.S. government is very concerned with measurability. So we would expect that to come from the U.S. government.
Absolutely. I mean, I think you see that in any kind of donor-driven environment. Donors want to know that their money isn't being wasted. So, I mean, I think having good analytics is something that donors are going to really embrace, and it may actually encourage them to get more money.
Is this the initiative begun by President Bush a couple of years ago?
That's right.
And not to get too political, but it seems like many of President Bush's critics do concede that his work against AIDS is one of his legacy achievements. Care to comment one way or the other?
Yeah, I mean, PEPFAR is an incredibly effective program. I don't think we would be where we are today. I mean, as I said, we're seeing mortality level off. We're seeing unprecedented gains in the number of people on treatment. And these are a large part due to the work that PEPFAR has done. So it's been a great organization.
Turning to another president, President Clinton, tell us about the Clinton Foundation Center for Strategic HIV Operations Research. How do you pronounce the abbreviation?
We say CSHOR.
CSHOR, okay.
Right.
That's memorable.
Yes.
What is it? What does it do?
So we're basically the operations research team at CHAI, the Clinton HIV AIDS Initiative. So we try to put a little bit of analytic rigor behind CHAI's work. Not to say that the rest of CHAI isn't also analytical, but we try to bring some of the OR tenets, things about resource planning and allocation, using simulation and statistics.
The OR department.
We are CHAI. The OR department, right. And we do a lot of work building simple, pragmatic sorts of models and tools that we can use, for example, to give out to help do drug forecasting in a country. And so we're basically the OR department for CHAI.
Tell us about some of the problem areas where analytics and OR have the potential to make a difference. I'm thinking of deploying limited number of healthcare workers and some of the other things that you've addressed.
Yeah, sure. I mean, CSHOR has some great work that we've been able to do using simulation models to look at questions like how facilities run. For example, we can have an agent-based simulation or individual-based simulation where we have people who move through the facility over time and they get older and they may have to switch drugs because they have toxicity events and they require a certain number of resources. They have to see doctors and nurses and they require time from data clerks. So we have this model and then we can tweak the model in order to say what would happen if, say, we took some of the jobs that doctors are doing right now and we asked laymen, like data clerks, to take this job over. So maybe it's something like a prescribing a drug where we don't actually need the doctor's involvement. And then we can use the model to quantify what the resource savings would be. So we've been able to use that in places like in Rwanda recently. We did an engagement where we looked at some new protocols where we take tasks away from doctors, and we were able to say, if you implement these protocols, we expect that you'll see this many hours in savings of your doctors, and you can use that time to see more patients or do, you know, have more quality care because your doctors can spend more time with patients.
In the Western world, you would ask a nurse to be doing this, and here you were basically handing a pill, letting a clerk deliver a pill, which doesn't require...
Right. I mean, we have to be careful, obviously, that we don't, you know, that we're within the realm of country guidelines. We never suggest things that aren't in national guidelines.
Sure.
But within that, there are oftentimes countries will come to us with these requests. They might say, they're thinking about switching guidelines. They heard there's a new drug that they would like to use. And they might come to us and say, can you tell us what the costs are going to be? Is this going to be more expensive? Are we actually going to need more doctors because need to be more visits in order to make sure patients are doing okay on the drug? And we can use the models in order to simulate that.
One of the things that you've discussed is using modeling to reduce transmission from mother to child. Mm-hmm. Would you like to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, there are a number of places where where mothers are being lost to care, where we really could treat pregnant mothers and prevent their children from ever being infected. Mm-hmm. That's fully possible. And it's done, but not frequently enough. So I don't remember the statistic exactly, but a very large number of pregnant mothers are not being treated for reasons that just aren't very good. And it's not beneficial from many perspectives. When these children are born HIV positive, A, they have their whole life ahead of them of being HIV positive. But from a cost-effectiveness point of view, you now have to treat these children for their entire lives. If you had just treated their mother when they were pregnant, you could have prevented that. So one of the places we've been looking at this is in Malawi. They want to start treating more pregnant women and preventing this maternal transmission. However, they're worried that if they start bringing more women into the clinics, they're already overburdened. What's going to happen? Are they going to have enough money? Are their doctors going to be so overworked that they can't see enough patients? So what we're able to do is take our simulation modeling and say, this is what it's going to cost to bring these people in over time. Here are the number of new doctors you're going to have to hire, and here are the number of new resources you're going to have to secure.
Using modeling to change the size of equipment so it can be carried to the field. Mm-hmm. I think you give an example of that in your talk.
Yeah, I mean, point-of-care technology is what we call this. And it's this new technology is really going to improve how we do treatment. Right now, to do a CD4 test, so you measure CD4, this is the T cells, your immune response, and it's an indicator of how far HIV has progressed. If your immune response goes down very far, then HIV, you're on your way to AIDS. So we measure these tests over time to see where you're at. Unfortunately, that requires expensive equipment, and these machines that we run the tests on are usually in big facilities, so maybe in the city, because it requires mm-hmm. air conditioning, it requires a trained staff, all of these things. So you have to get the tests from very rural places. You have to drive them or, you know, get them somehow to these facilities, run the tests, bring them back. In the meanwhile, the person has gone back to their home and they have to return to the clinic. Mm-hmm. So all of these things are bad because you're first delaying the amount of time before the person can get back on treatment, but also because you're increasing the risk that you lose them, that they're not going to come back to the system because they've just, you know, maybe they had to go harvest crops or something else has come up. A child was sick, so they couldn't return. So point-of-care technology's idea is that right away we could just take their blood sample and get a result, and then we can start them on treatment. We don't have to worry about these repeat visits. It really has the potential to change a lot of how treatment is done.
Well, it sounds exciting. It sounds very important.
It's very exciting, and one of the ways that we can help with it is by trying to estimate what the total demand for these products might be. Because on a test-by-test basis, it could be more expensive to do this. But once we take into account this entire complex system of costs, indirect costs, direct costs, like transportation and air conditioning and all of these things, we could demonstrate that in some places it may actually be cost-efficient.
And one final question. Tell us what's ahead for Seashore this year and coming years.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an exciting time for Seashore. We're a pilot, really. We are operating under a grant from the Gates Foundation, and the idea was to demonstrate that operations research could be done in global health. Now, I'm not technically, you know, my background is in operations research, but I think we've been able to pull a lot of the logic and the principles from OR and some of the modeling and simulation. I think we've definitely shown that there's a lot of space for this to take off. What we need to do over the next few years, and it's not going to be just us, but is to take the things where we've been really successful and replicate them and show others how they can also get into this sphere. And what I'd like to see down the road is that other organizations are also pulling for better data systems, for better data, and making the decisions about new interventions based on these sorts of quantitative, analytic kinds of analyses. I think if we can do that, we'll be able to extend access to these life-saving medications and preventative measures. And I think operations research is going to have a big role there.
That's all the time we have today. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Justin Cohen of the Clinton Foundation about his analytical work in the fight against the AIDS epidemic in Africa. This is Barry List of Informs. We've been broadcasting from the Spring 2009 Informs Practice Meeting in Phoenix, Arizona. At the conference, operations researchers and experts in analytics have been discussing problems facing business and government, and in turn, the way that quantitative experts can find approaches to solving these problems. Information about the upcoming 2010 Informs Practice Meeting is at www.informs.org. Thank you for listening to this Science of Better podcast by Informs, the Institute for Operations Research and the Management Sciences. For more information about operations research and the series of podcasts, visit us on the web, again, at www.informs.org. Good day, and remember, keep on crunching those numbers.